Okay, I think before we do the prayer, let me just give a brief introduction of Geshe-la. Okay. So I think most of you have received the email regarding Geshe-la's introduction, so I won't go into much detail. So I have known Geshe-la for many years, and I remember that when I first joined monastery, I think Geshe-la's class was somewhere, I think already in Vinaya, or maybe end of Madhyamika. So I always look forward for Geshe-la's class to have debate, because Geshe-la's class, they have monks who are, I mean, their debating style is very exciting, and Geshe-la makes a lot of jokes. That's why we really find it entertaining. So anyway, Geshe-la started monastic study at Buddhist Dialectic Institute of Buddhist Dialectics in Dharamsala. And then later, Geshe-la joined Losiling Monastery, where Geshe-la received Geshe Tharamba degree. And Geshe-la also has a master's degree in English literature from Punjab University in India. And Geshe-la also served the principal of monastery school for 5 years. And during that time, I had the opportunity to attend Geshe-la's Buddhist terminology classes. And later, Geshe-la moved to the Central Institute of Higher Tibetan Studies in Varanasi, and Geshe-la lectured there for 7 years. And then Geshe-la, in 2010, Geshe-la moved to America and served as senior resident teachers at Tibung Losili Monastery. And later Geshe-la began his current position at Emory University, which is involved in preparing a 6 years bilingual curriculum in modern sciences. So the monks have already been using these textbooks. And Geshe-la also very often serves as a translator to His Holiness. And of course, Geshe-la's scholarship is no question. But I think I always, this is my view. You know, we have many scholars who are really, really, you know, all that level of scholarship. But then, you know, when it comes to practice, very few people really practice. But I find Geshe-la not only a scholar, but also a great practitioner. Mm. And that's why you don't hear, I was surprised that many of you have not even heard of Geshe-la, because it's always low-key. Despite that knowledge, and Geshe-la is known, you know, I don't know whether Geshe-la is aware or not. In monastery, we say that, oh, Geshe-la is from the tip of his hair to the, you know, the top of his, the foot nail. He says that it's all knowledge.
By the way, I'm not that tall.
yeah. That's what monastery. I mean, the monks will say that, oh, it's full of knowledge. So we are very honored to have you teach us for this class, and thank you very much on behalf of Kajuling Center, and also on behalf of members. I would like to thank you very much for Geshe-la's time and giving us this opportunity. Thank you, Geshe-la.
Thank you, Geshe-la. Thank you for this opportunity. I'll first let you do the practice then.
Tam pa chom den de de je je va ja jom ba yam da va zo ve san ge ve pa dan shav zo den ba de va she ba ji ten ke ke bo de ve ka lo ju va la na me ba la da mi nam ki tom ba san ge chom den de pya gya va shav ya tu ba la cha ze lo jo do ja zo jo tom ba chom den de de je
Shabbat, Bushala, before I start, what is our timeline going to look like? Do you want to?
We have actually, from our time, from 10 to 12, we have 2 hours. But normally we have a break of 15 minutes at 11. So that's okay. Not too well, I think.
Yeah, okay. Okay, so I'll try to remember that. Okay, we'll have a short break and then we'll... first of all, I want to thank you all, particularly Rinpochela, for this opportunity to familiarize with the Dharma. Now that I see Rinpoche slightly under the weather today, so it worked out very well for me to speak. Yes. Otherwise, there's nothing special for me. I earlier thought he was just looking for an excuse to give himself a break. but then it turned out that it worked out so well. Rinpoche is under weather, so that I could substitute for him. So earlier, Rinpoche asked for teaching. I don't teach. If at all I do anything that you could call something in English that starts with T, then that would be teasing. And teasing I do not to anybody else but to myself. Kind of making it clear, kind of bringing it up front, the big gap between what I say and what I practice. That's how I have no choice but to get teased by myself when I share Dharma. So that's what I would do, and for sure I would benefit from that. By the end of the time, I would have been exposed to myself a lot. So that way, I would then maybe learn something from that. So with that said, I understand that Rinpoche has been leading Lamrim teaching, right?
Yes, just
Lamrim.
Yes. Yeah.
Lamrim teaching, and has reached up to the wisdom section. Is that so?
Yeah, we're supposed to have covered all that, but we only finished the first three. Yeah.
I see.
Yeah.
But anyway, Rinpoche, you are asking me to dwell on the wisdom part, right?
Yeah, because I feel that I won't do any justice to this chapter. So that's why I'm requesting Geshe.
See, Rinpoche is again putting the pressure on me. So that's what I understood to share on this topic of wisdom. The perfection of wisdom, if you will, but more so the wisdom itself. Many of you may have been acquainted with the Dharma for long, and thus may recall certain stanzas in the Bodhicharyavatara by Shantideva, where in his 9th chapter, which is on wisdom, he starts that chapter by saying all of these previous teachings, all of these previous chapters that we have covered on the other perfections, they were all taught by Buddha to prepare ourselves for this particular chapter, namely the 9th chapter on wisdom. All these branches of teachings Buddha had taught as a means of preparing for this perfection of wisdom. So that ties in very well with the very basic very basic position or very basic thesis, if you will, of Buddhism in that all our efforts to rid ourselves of suffering, of unwanted situations, have to be addressed, if possible, in the most thorough way, by striking at its very root. And the root has been identified as ignorance. So, given that ignorance is at the root of the suffering, at the root of the afflictions, which in turn lead to sufferings of one kind or the other, if that is the case, then of course all other means would fall short of the potential to thoroughly undo the ignorance. So that's the idea. So in this regard, even such lofty practices as love, compassion, bodhicitta, of course, they have their own specific benefits, whatnot. Well, far-reaching benefits. But in terms of striking at the heart of the ignorance, they all fall short of that, unless and until they are complemented with the wisdom. Of course, wisdom cultivated to this level of really managing to deal a blow to the affliction, to the ignorance at the root of the affliction, has to be complemented, has to be enhanced, complemented, facilitated, grounded in non-wisdom, what do you call, method aspect of practices. But when it comes to the actual striking to do in the face of the ignorance, all of these means will fall short of really doing the expected job. So that's the reason why wisdom is so crucial in the ultimate, right? So, and when we speak of wisdom in this sense, we're not speaking of wisdom in ordinary sense, in general sense, but rather we're speaking of wisdom in a very pointed way, in a very refined, specific way. Wisdom that, in the first place, exposes the ignorance, and not only exposes the ignorance in terms of its mistake, in terms of its mode of apprehension, but also succeeds in kind of gradually, but slowly but gradually, replacing it from its stronghold within our being. That's the reason why the wisdom being called for here is not just wisdom in the sense of understanding only, albeit if that be understanding to the core of where the ignorance is mistaken. But wisdom here is more in the sense of course, beginning with an understanding that exposes the ignorance to its very core, what do you call, mode of apprehension, but at the same time, something that has gained in its strength in really dealing with the different layers, if you will, different layers of that same ignorance, in that the ignorance has built its strong hold in our core being for such a long time without ever being questioned, if at all, being even more supported, whatnot. Thus, its strength has become so entrenched within us that the effort that goes in dealing with it, even allowing that one has the wisdom, the correct wisdom to strike at it, would have to be, what do you call, slow but gradual chipping off, if you will, gradual chipping off of the hold, grip of this ignorance within us. So that's the general idea, why wisdom is needed. Because at the core of the sufferings, if we are aiming at doing a thorough job in really getting rid of the suffering at the superficial level, as well as its causal elements in the form of afflictions and whatnot, if we want to do a thorough job in kind of almost chipping them off of our mental continuum, and eventually completely uprooting them, then yes, such a wisdom is indispensable. Otherwise, we could just settle on other practices shy of such wisdom, and be just be content with dealing with the afflictions in a very superficial way, kind of dodging and kind of almost playing a hide and seek with the afflictions. Or if one is more successful than that, kind of being able to kind of push and pull it a little bit here and there, but not really make any inroad into the very mechanism of these afflictions, to eventually be able to kind of totally displace it from our core being. So that's kind of the general idea behind that. So in that respect, we have to first understand what is ignorance. As simple as it may sound like, it is not that simple. In Buddhism, when we speak of ignorance, we particularly speak of ignorance in two forms. One more or less takes the form of not knowing, but more particularly not knowing in the field of what causes what. More particularly, what leads to suffering? What are the causes of suffering? What are the causes of peace and joy and happiness? So ignorance with regard to the causal relationship of what leads to suffering, what leads to ignorance, what leads to suffering, what leads to peace, whatnot. So ignorance, not in a naive, blackout kind of a sense, but rather ignorance either in the sense of misconstruing what leads to peace, joy, happiness, or having a very, very naive idea about it. Or in some cases, it could be just complete blackout in terms of what leads to what. So that's one level of ignorance. Of course, that needs to be dealt with by educating ourselves in a more thorough, serious way, complemented by one's own experience. We are all, in a way, living laboratories. We are ourselves very well-furnished laboratories. If only we care to look inside and see what leads to suffering, what leads to joy and peace, no matter whatever fleeting instances we may have of them. But if we only care to look deep into what led to what, kind of take a moment in kind of looking back and play it over in a slow motion, and then get to see what leads to what and whatnot. Oh, there's great prospect of really making a big progress in terms of knowing what leads to suffering, what leads to peace, and whatnot. So that's the way of dealing with the ignorance at this level. But there is, at least from a Buddhist perspective, there is even takes the form not of not knowing, but an active form of complete misconstruing. And that too, misconstruing not just about anything, but the very, very fundamental nature of how things exist. In Tibetan, we call that Dekona Nyila Mungbe Marikpa. Lende La Mungbe Marikpa. I see some Tibetans, so for their benefit. Lende La Mungbe Marikpa. Ignorance that is lost in terms of what leads to what result, be that in the happiness, joy, peace aspect, or that of suffering, misery aspect. Lende lamongbe marikpa. And then the other one is called tekonanyi lamongbe marikpa. The ignorance that is lost in terms of what is the suchness of things, what is the basic mode of existence of things. So here it is not just lost in the sense of having no idea, but more in the sense of a complete misconstruing of it. So much so that there's this process of completely misconstruing it in a diametrically opposite way. So that is, among the two levels of ignorance, that is more crucial, that is more fundamental. And that is the very foundation, indispensable lifeline for all the afflictions. One thing good about this is that this ignorance, no matter how entrenched in it is, how strongly built it is within us, and how, what you call, pervasive it is, yeah, in terms of our thinking, habits, etc., it is nonetheless mistaken. It is mistaken. So if it is a mistake, then irrespective of whether we succeed or not, it always leaves the room for it to be exposed in the first place, and then weakened without having to resort to any kind of faking up, in the current situation. Okay, maybe I will not use that term. But nonetheless, without having to fake up about how things have it, I mean, how things exist or whatnot, just pursuing the reality that could be born with reason, finding, etc. But that way, one could expose this ignorance and weaken it. So that's the good thing about this ignorance. But nonetheless, it is not that easy to see through it. And that we will begin to see. We'll begin to see as we move forward, because we would have so many disagreements. And that is indicative of how, on the one hand, how delicate this topic is, how how ripe is this topic in being mistaken, in being misconstrued, in being understood differently, in being interpreted so many ways, whatnot. Yet at the same time, it is an indication of how much we have been kind of buying into it. So that's important thing to make a connection between the place of wisdom and our journey of pursuit for genuine, lasting peace, happiness for oneself and for others. How the main stumbling block is the ignorance. And within the two broad categories of ignorance, it is the latter one, which is more fundamental. Yes, in the Lamrim scripture, you may have noticed, when it comes to speaking about the means of dealing with the afflictions, it mentions two main ways. One is called Jeba Namjung. Jeba Namjung in the sense of dealing with the afflictions, not so much by making inroad into its mechanism, but by way of, what do you call, soothing it out, by way of kind of soothing the surface, the problematic surface of it, so that the pang of its the pang from its existence could be soothed out, could be smoothened out, but not so much succeeding in making inroad into the affliction. So that's one way. Another way is called Nyumong Namjong, where the antidotes adopt a more stronger force in that they make inroad into the very mechanism of the afflictions, and thus when pursued, that can have the possibility of eventually kind of uprooting it, eventually eliminating it. So here, in the wisdom aspect, we'll be dealing more with this later approach, because the practice of love, compassion, understanding, all other skillful means, all other method aspects of the practices, they directly or indirectly involve or comprise the first level of dealing with the afflictions. There are all these means that we bring forward in the form of spiritual practice, be that devotion, faith, patience, tolerance, whatnot. They fall in this first aspect of dealing with the afflictions, in that they do not necessarily, unless they are complemented with their wisdom, they do not necessarily succeed in making inroad into the afflictions, but rather kind of dealing with the afflictions while its own nature is kept intact, but kind of maybe soothing it out, kind of maybe pressing it down, but not so much in terms of really making inroad into the mechanism of the affliction, so that it could kind of almost implode it. Right, so that's what all these method aspects practices do, but they fall short of really making an inroad into the afflictions. So that's how I, even though there we can speak of wisdom in those practices, I will not include that in this specific section of separate allocation for wisdom, after having dealt with all those elaborate method practices. So, in this regard, as I said earlier, this ignorance of the two, the more fundamental one, which takes the form of misconstruing the very nature of things, very mode of existence of things. They are called by different names, but nonetheless, by that we refer to them as some kind of a innate disposition within us, not something necessarily acquired anew, at least from a Buddhist perspective, something that we through continuous habituation, I happen to carry them deep into our own core, so much so that they kind of are integrated in our mentality, in our state of being while in samsara. So that's why the effort in dealing with this requires, what do you call, sustained effort. Of course, beginning with the insight into the nature of reality and thus exposing the mode of apprehension of the ignorance itself, but kind of then sustaining one's effort in familiarizing with that, in integrating that with one's mentality, so that eventually the actual, what do you call, antidotal efforts would take place in the face of the affliction or in the face of the ignorance themselves. Let me back off a little bit and then put it into perspective. In our daily life, we can somewhat agree that our sufferings, more particularly mental sufferings, and of course even physical sufferings, physical imbalances, ill health, I mean indirectly have a great connection with our mental well-being, mental state. And our mental state is kind of disturbed by the afflictions. So in a way, our more, what you call, obvious apparent mental imbalances in the form of depression, stress, anxiety, etc., together with their, what you call, corollary physical imbalances, they are, at least from a Buddhist perspective, either immediately or in a long-term sense, caused by the afflictions. And the afflictions, in turn, are rooted in the ignorance, and that too ignorance, more particularly that of the one that misconstrues the nature of reality. In so much so that, as I said earlier, all of these afflictions, irrespective of their own specific natures, specific features, specific aspects that may have been contributed by their own specific, unique contributors, whatnot, but nonetheless, they all deep down share in having been, what do you call, fed, in having been fed, informed by this ignorance. So, and that ignorance is, as much as you may have noticed, I have shied away from really pinpointing that so far, except for saying ignorance, I have shied away from actually pinpointing it, what I actually meant by that, right? So we'll move on to identify that. But it is not that easy. It is not that easy, nor is that that accessible right away, unless and until one has certain conditions built in terms of the, what you call, in terms of pursuits in that regard. So that's the reason why, even in Buddha's own teachings, he presents it in stages. He prepares sentient beings, or he prepares those who are interested in looking into these and wondering and looking into these. He presents kind of as steps leading to them, not present the whole thing right away. Of course, to some, that would be what would be feeding, but for some, that would not be feeding, that would not be beneficial, but rather they have to be led in steps. That's the reason why you find this topic being approached in, what do you call, in doses, if you will. And that is very apparent in this, what do you call, layout of the four schools of thought in Buddhism, more particularly in the Tibetan Buddhist systems. So you may be familiar with the four schools of thoughts, namely the Vaibhashika, the Sautantrika, the Chittamatra, and the Madhyamika. Each one of them kind of presents a comprehensive worldview within the fold of the Buddhist, yet nonetheless, each presents a different worldview among themselves. And when viewed horizontally, so to say, when viewed individually, they would all sound and look very different, even to the extent of being contradictory to each other. But then, when you kind of look at them as stepping stones, as ladders, kind of arrange them in a vertical form, then one would begin to see the reason behind that, see the logic of how each serves as a means, as a pedestal to leading to the next one. And within each of these schools, you will see so many different topics that they take up and treat them in this fashion, in that one particular topic will be dealt in certain way to a certain extent by one particular school, and then the next one kind of takes on from there, and then the next one takes on from there, if required, even refining the previous position, whatnot. And that way, it kind of systematically leads to what you call more refinement to the intended, if you will, intended, what do you call, intended meaning by the Buddha. And in this regard, in regard to wisdom, I want to pinpoint maybe two, three topics that you might want to look into in detail and compare the positions of these schools among themselves, and then begin to sense some kind of a logic in a gradual refinement in them, leading to what we understand as the intended meaning of the Buddha, at least at the sutra level that he wanted to convey. So one topic is called Zeyu Tayu, right? One topic is called Zeyu Tayu. Zeyu Tayu in Tibet, in English, they are translated as substantial existence and imputed existence. So these schools take up this topic, and they take their liberty in kind of in defining them. And more often than not, you will see the lower schools taking a grosser take, and then that is being attacked or questioned, critiqued, and then that's refined. So there's one topic called Zeyu and Tayu, substantial existence and imputed existence. Then there is another one, the true truths. The true truths is one topic that all of these tenet schools take up, but they vary in terms of how they define it. Again, if you look closely, you will see how they differ and how, when they are put in order in terms of the positions of the lower school first, followed by the next one, eventually to that of the Madhyamika, you will begin to see or appreciate what do you call a deliberate, gradual refinement of the topic. Just to give you an example, in the system of the lowest school, that of the Vaibhashika, the true truths are understood as something totally different. It's like the entirety of the existence could be divided into the so-called relative truth and the ultimate truth. Although the translation of this Dvandam Temba as ultimate doesn't hold good here in this school. People use this translation and then apply it to across the board. Wherever there is a mention of Dvandam Temba, they kind of right away use this English translation as of ultimate reality. But here it doesn't hold good because by their way of dividing the entirety of existence into the true truths, they do not mean to arrive at an ultimate something when they speak of one group as the Dvandam Temba, as the so-called ultimate truth. But so they divide the entire existence into two. It's almost like dividing the entire existence into two groups and call one the one name and the other. Whereas as you move on to the higher schools, you'll begin to see how the true truths are not to be seen as some totally, two different groups, but rather one could posit the true truths in one single thing, right? It's rather a matter of dealing with the superficial nature of the things that could be called relative truth, and then the underlying, deep down, underlying fundamental nature is the ultimate truth. So there, the connotation holds some sense of ultimate in the sense of fundamental or the essential underlying nature. And then there's this topic about selflessness of person. Although out of the four schools, the first two schools speak of selflessness of person, and then it is not until the third school, that of the Chittamatra and beyond, they begin to speak of an additional selflessness of phenomena on top of selflessness of person. Although they may use the same term, selflessness of person, selflessness of phenomena, whatnot, but they mean different. The very content of them, the implication of them are very different. So by that, I just mean to just give you some clue of how to approach, how to utilize this system of the four schools in deepening one's understanding on any given particular topic by first seeing what the Vaibhashika's take is, and then following that with that of the Sautantrika's take, and then see how the Chittamatras differ, how the Madhyamikas differ, and what are the contradictions, how they critique them, how they make the case for that, etc., etc. So that's kind of a clue to what to look for, how to utilize the four schools. So that's it. Now I'm going to come to the actual content of this. With regard to the nature of things. So from a Buddhist perspective, in a broad sense, afflictions, first we have to agree that the sufferings the immediate ones, more particularly the mental immediate suffering, the mental immediate disruptions, right? Disruptions or turmoil that we feel, they are the result of the afflictions there. And then when we fall prey to them, fall under their spell, then our whole being could be misdirected and then led to more untoward expressions of it in the form of actions that could have far-reaching implications or whatnot. So, first and foremost, we have to see, yes, the superficial sufferings that we can identify, they are in essence or in a deeper level rooted in the afflictions. Right? That one has to see if one could agree, if one could, affirm or from one's own experience. Once we see that, that every time we fall prey to these afflictions, every time we give rise to these afflictions, it risks one's mental balance, it risks one's mental well-being, and also risk being, led into untoward within oneself and around oneself. Rinpoche, did you do something?
Just now it was frozen for a while.
Oh, I see. Okay. So, I was saying that the fundamental ignorance is related to the fundamental nature of things, how things exist. And there, the core concept that Buddha intended us to arrive at is not that apparent, is not that obvious to be arrived at easily. And thus he leads us step by step towards that. Just as he does that, or we see that being the case with other topics that I've just mentioned. So in this regard, you will see three major steps moving towards, first and foremost, understanding the actual, or rather the realistic mode of existence of things, so that that could be contrasted with how we apprehend normally, and thus question the validity of our taken for granted apprehension of things, and then from there begin to understand, begin to expose our mistake, begin to expose the incongruency in how we normally view things. So what are those three steps that we find built into this school? The first one is that of atomism, right? In the case of physical things, the first one is that of reductionist, be that in the form, in the realm of physical phenomena, or be that in the realm of internal consciousness. And that's a very good starting point, because that's what most of us, irrespective of whether we are informed or not, educated or not, speculative or not, we tend to take that for granted. We think that, yes, of course, physical things obviously could be reduced down to its subatomic substratums, right? Substratus or subatomic building blocks, and then that's how they meet, the coming together of them may lead to the building, the bigger macroscopic structures. Likewise, with the consciousness also, we may think like consciousness is a temporal thing that kind of spans over time, and they could be kind of they could be built from temporal paths thereof, and then which could then eventually be reduced down to maybe the individual temporal consciousness, which serves as the building block for everything. So by doing so, it kind of keeps intact our own usual initial comfort zone, initial unquestioned, taken for granted kind of way of looking at things, like, oh, that's how things could be, things should be. And what that does is that kind of spells out what our usual take amounts to. What it amounts to is it amounts to ascribing some kind of a objective reality to whatever it is, be that physical things in terms of its being reducible to its own physical substratas, and that the inner feelings, inner consciousness and whatnot, reducible to its own, essential temporal building blocks. So in a way, this approach could be seen, if I were to use the metaphor of a photographer, kind of starting out with a big lens, wide lens, and then kind of eventually trying to kind of zoom in and focus, while in focus, kind of zoom into the essential, the very core nature of things. Kind of one kind of starts with a wide lens where we kind of see what we usually think things exist, and then things exist the way they seem to us. And then what we do is we kind of undertake a more thorough analysis of it, and then begin to question that, begin to see more deeper realities into it. So that's what it does when this the next perspective, that of the Chitta Mantras, are brought in, where it questions the externality of things, saying it usually this can be more understandable when we talk of values, when we talk of values where each individual person has a different take, and how they see is dependent on so many different factors, rather than something that could be very easily ascribable to a physical, universal physical reality in and of itself, but rather is dependent on so much subjective background, right? But likewise, we can also apply that to a certain extent to even physical things in terms of what we see. We could question as to whether what I see visually is something that others see. So that way, it kind of brings some kind of a questioning to the solidity, or taken for granted, reality, the objective reality of things. Although just to warn you, Chitta Mantra perspective, even in the Buddhist context, is not taken as something that could be valid through and through, but rather it has been proposed as some kind of a temporary stepping stone, if you will, to kind of then make the adjustment into make the adjustment more into the central position to then eventually move to the intended Buddha's intention. But it takes this risk of kind of shifting to the one extreme of a spectrum in saying that all there is just the mind. Everything is just mere projection of the mind. In that, the so-called external things that we seem to take for granted, such as saying that what I see is what everybody sees, when that is put into question, then that the kind of one begins to wonder whether there is an external reality out there in and of themselves, instead of things being kind of very, what do you call, very much influenced by the subjective beings or the subjective agents. But one has to remember that the whole mission in Buddha's teaching, like it is the case with so many of the major religions, despite the fact that there is a big difference in terms of our philosophical positions, but nonetheless, the very core mission is same in enhancing the prospects of joy, peace of the sentient beings, of the beings, right? So likewise in Buddhism also, that is the very core mission in behind whatever teachings are laid out. And so is the case with this philosophical teaching too. The mission behind that is to bring along sentient beings in their mission of alleviating suffering and enhancing prospects of joy and happiness. And so here too, one could make a case that when the abject, what do you call, physicality, the abject, what do you call, objectivity of things are questioned, what it does is it does question our uptightness. When it comes to thinking of things, thinking of oneself, thinking of one's conditions, one's relations with others. It's kind of that uptightness, that, what you call, grasping at a solid, concrete nature is put into question, and that helps in loosening our grip a little bit, and thus kind of bringing in more flexibility in our dealings with these situations, and thus that helps in what do you call, kind of bringing in some ease in our dealing with things, and thus not fall prey as much into the hands of the afflictions. So that's the idea behind that, and as we'll see later, the attempt here is, of course, while resorting to reality or any kind of a means which kind of brings us closer to the reality, while it does that, what it aims at doing is kind of in the face of the reality itself, kind of making us more in tune with the flexible nature of the reality in terms of the nature of things, in terms of the relations, and thus kind of keep us off the hook of this, what do you call, very concretized, objectivized, kind of a way of looking at things in a very clear-cut, compartmentalizing of things. So that's the idea behind that. But in that respect, we start out first from where we find ourselves. I mean, not necessarily everyone, but most of us find ourselves in this assumption that there has got to be a world out there, objective, physical, objective, kind of a clear-cut way that we tend to see. And likewise, we see the same thing with our inner world also, in terms of being very clear-cut and demarcated, whatnot. And we start from there and then begin to kind of question the validity of that by bringing in the Chittamatra perspective. And then kind of supplementing it, or rather making it full by bringing it, by critiquing it where it falls short, and then kind of making it complete by bringing in that Madhyamika perspective. But there too, it doesn't move right away. It provides for a perspective in between, kind of that makes the journey easy, right? It makes the journey more natural to eventually come to the Madhyamika perspective, but rather in a more natural way. So we'll begin to see yet another step in between before we come to the Madhyamika perspective. And that, irrespective of how much we are ready to agree or not, is supposed to kind of present the actual reality of things, and that will find to be in stark, opposition, in stark contradiction to our very ingrained, ingrained sense of how things exist. So that's it. I think we could stop here.
Yes,
thank you. So, welcome back. So, basically, this endeavor leading to building the right wisdom to be able to strike at the core of the ignorance in this more fundamental form involves beginning to see or appreciate nature in a much more flexible way than we tend to ascribe it to be. Then we tend to hold on to them to be kind of clear cut, demarcated, self enclosed things. That's what we're aiming at. Breaking it down to be able to see things, relations, just about everything without exception in a much more realistically fluid, of course interdependent, related nature, but more in a fluid nature, not at the cost of the conventional reality of things, but instead bringing us closer to the reality of how things function the way they do, how it is possible, on the basis of appreciating, to come to an appreciation of reality, of course, as it is, and which is beginning to see them in a much more fluid, interconnected, related way. In this regard, I'm reminded of the Vietnamese Zen master, Thich Nhat Hanh.
Yeah.
His way of relating this by saying that by instituting this practice of what he calls interbeing, and that way, by extension, we could think of ourselves as that I inter M, you inter R, we inter R. So, beginning to see the interrelatedness of things, to the extent, of course, at this point, at the point of the Chitta Matra, it goes in this effort to kind of readjust our appreciation of the reality from this completely misconstrued, completely, what do you call, almost 180 degree wrong, to gradually move to first appreciating it, first appreciating it in what it entails in terms of really seeing things kind of reducible to their own respective substratums, to eventually question the externality of them, to question the existence of things independent of the mind, independent of the mental states, elements. But in doing so, purposefully, this shift is brought to another end, where we end up, reifying the subjective elements in turn. Of course, we may undermine the independent objective physicality of things to the point of saying maybe all there is mind, and that everything is mental projection. Of course, in this regard, it is slightly different than the Western idealism. Sometimes I kind of see Western idealism going even further than the Buddhist idealism in terms of undermining the physical world. Because in the Buddhist tradition, the Citta Matra, the so-called Buddhist idealists, do not rule out, at least in accordance with one iteration of it. Of course, scholars differ in this, particularly in the understanding of Tsongkhapa. The Buddhist idealism in the form of Citta Matra do not go to the extent of ruling out the external world. It doesn't deny the existence of buildings, houses, trees out there. But rather it says that it is there as a projection of the mind. It's almost like the mind itself has projected onto them, and they are engulfed into this mental projection and ever ready to be drawn in. But doesn't, in the wake of doing so, doesn't rule out the actual physicality of things. It only rules out external things being external to the mind. So that's why we say the externalism is denied, not physicality per se. Anyway, but what it does is it ends up reifying the subjective components to the extent of saying, yes, mind not only exists, but also enjoys a certain, status of independence. Because of its being, a certain status of independence over the physicality, over the physical world, so much so that the physical world is reducible to a mere projection of the mind. So that's where this is kind of a deliberate shift almost like a radical shift from our technical granted, what you call technical granted position of the seeing the world as we do in terms of having their own independent individual independence or individual their individuals almost like a self-enclosed existence of their own. So then and then with this deliberate shift to the other end of the spectrum, the contrast becomes very clear, and also it lays the ground to again critique this shift, to again critique this lopsidedness in terms of how does the consciousness, the subjective agent, counterpart, enjoys such a special status of independence, and the status is juxtaposed to that of the external reality, and then more particularly it questions the independent status of the mind over the physical reality, over the physical world. And in the meantime, yet another, another position is proposed, which kind of compensates for this lopsidedness by saying, yes, things both physical and mental do exist, but not in this radically, different way, in that one is reduced to almost non-existence in and of itself, where the other one is elevated to this status of enjoying an independent existence. So it kind of does this compromise by bringing the shift to the center by saying maybe it's a case of things being dependent on the subjective mind, yet at the same time enjoy some kind of individuality on their own, and the combination of the two kind of makes the case for things existing the way they do, being capable of the functions that they are capable, but not in a completely objectively independent way, nor at the same time being completely dependent on a subjective mind to the extent of being reducible to just being a mere projection of it. So just to give you an example, it kind of brings this shift from this radical position of saying that all there is mind, and what mind projects is what you get, to saying, say somebody becoming a teacher or whatnot, saying that no, it's not totally like that. The teacher, for her to be worthy of this position, has to have some qualities from her side, yet at the same time that is not the whole story. Rather, there should be some kind of a hand in who chooses him or her, a kind of system that she goes through, kind of a selection system where so many factors could kind of play out in then choosing someone with the basic criteria that they may share with others, but not necessarily get chosen. So anyway, some kind of a compromise is brought here in terms of allowing for some kind of a partial objective reality and partial subjective imputation, and then the two kind of combines to make the whole picture of the reality of things. So in one of Tsongkhapa's texts, he says that though from a pure mathematical point of view, this kind of a compromise is still an over-exaggeration. It amounts to an over-exaggeration of the actual nature of things. It falls short of refuting objective reality through and through, but nonetheless, he complements this justifiable resting place, in a way, justifiable stepping stone to now move into the right direction of understanding the Madhyamika, the ultimate intent of his in terms of how things exist. And in terms of how things exist dependently, without a kind of an independent status of its own, there is no difference between the so-called physical world and the internal world of consciousness, mind, whatnot. But at the same time, in terms of the element of objectivity, or in terms of element of, for lack of a better word, inherent existence, or intrinsic existence, there is no difference whatsoever between the physical world and the subjective world in having even the slightest iota of it. It rules out the rejection of objectivity, the rejection of the inherent nature of things should go to the utmost, thus leaving not the slightest iota of any objectivity. And that if one were to push even a little beyond that, it would lead for no other choice but to revert to the same position of proposing or accepting inherent existence. So the rejection or the refutation of the inherent existence should be utmost, should be exhausted, while at the same time being able to posit the functionality, operationality, of course including the difference of the things among themselves as they are, and thus within that leaving the room for any kind of a change, be that natural or be that deliberately brought in. So what this suggests is that one will be able to situate the functionality, operationality of things without having to subscribe to, without having to rely on any iota of intrinsic nature, intrinsic inherent component, but rather it is within the place of total negation of any iota of inherent existence that one should be able to fully posit the fully posit the possibility, fully posit or make the case for the possibility of things being operational and functional. And that by doing so, one doesn't make it any less of a reality, rather affirms the actual reality of this interconnectedness within which all of these prospects of making changes for the good, or else kind of slipping back into works, is all explainable, is all, what do you call, justifiable. So that's what that's what this understanding, starting from this extreme end of one spectrum to this middle way philosophy, where one doesn't have to subscribe any idea of inherent existence, any idea of independence, and yet at the same time do not fall into either subscribing that things are mere mental projection, like that of Vichitamatra, and at the same time not what do you call, having to subscribe to the cheap relativism of things, where we might say, oh, anything goes. We could just project or impute anything, and that's all it is. Not like that. So things are imputed, but not whatever we impute becomes. But whatever has become, whatever is there, whatever is possible, they're there by mere virtue of imputation. By mere virtue, imputation in the sense, by mere virtue of nothing intrinsic or nothing objective contributing to it, which leaves it to not a choice but being subjectively imputed. So in this regard, I want to share one thing. In Western psychology, I don't know much about this, but I have come across this statement ascribed to the Gestalt principle, where they say a whole is greater than the sum of its part. There are different iterations of it. Some say the whole is different than the sum of its parts. The whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And also I have heard that in maybe in Descartes' understanding, it would come to saying the whole is equal to the sum of the parts. In any case, I'm not making case for one against the other, but what I'm doing is I'm borrowing this statement ascribed to the Gestalt principle, where it says the whole is greater than the sum of its parts. And that seems to really come very close to conveying what the Madhyamika's understanding would come to. We all know that the whole is not the parts. It's definitely not. But the question here is, what about the sum of the parts? If it is not the sum of the parts, neither the parts themselves, then we are left with no choice but for the whole to be very mysteriously posited, but with no intrinsic factor contributing to it from the side, be that of the parts or the sum of the parts. In this regard, I usually just to make you think, like here, you see me just from the neck above, but and you say this is. So supposing that you actually see me with the from the neck above, right? And you say this is Gishidaru. Definitely, you are not saying the head is Gishidadu. So where did this, where do we seem to impute that? We're not mistaken in saying there is Geshe Dadhuo. But at the same time, if we were to check very closely, did you mean to impute it to what we see, which is to just what we see? Definitely not. If that is the case here, then even when we see someone fully, right? But when we see that from the back, from the front, from the side, whatever, there's no time when we would see the totality of that person. Yet at the same time, we will impute that person and we say that's the correct imputation. So where did the imputation fall on? Not on what you see. Yet at the same time, that is totally valid way of imputation. We're not speaking of mistaken imputation, mistaken identification. We're talking of correct identification. And another thing to emphasize here is that it is quite easy, and nobody expects, to find a thing when we look into the past. When we say, suppose we are looking at this cup and we try to kind of push ourselves in, we look at it from afar and then say, yes, this is the cup, we have no doubt. And that I'm holding it and I'm drinking from it, right? But the moment we question that and begin to wonder where exactly is the cup? What exactly is the cup? Then no matter where were we point, where were our fingers land on, we end up landing on a non-cup. And that's the case with everything. Everything, nothing is exceptional here from a Buddhist perspective. What about the sum of the parts? If the parts are not the whole, then the sum of the parts, by saying the sum of the parts may be the whole, it's just buying time. It's just putting it off a step further. But the moment we say it's a sum, the sum is nothing but made of parts, and the parts are not the whole. And this much it is easy to understand. From a Buddhist perspective, as much as we may usually hear people presenting Madhyamika through this kind of a metaphor, that is, at least from how I understand, based on scriptural sources, references, and at the same time, based on one's own reasoning, that is not the whole story. Not being able to find the cup, the moment we look into it, is an indication of something mysterious here. But it is not the whole story. Merely not finding cup within the parts is not landing on emptiness. That's what I meant to say. When we don't find the cup within the parts or the sum of it, at the very least, what we affirm is that the parts are not the cup. But it leaves one option untouched. Whatever is being other than it. We haven't resolved that. So, because for things to exist in relation to its parts, it could exist either being one with the parts, either any particular of them or whatnot, or other than the parts. And the way we look for it within the cups, within the parts of it, and don't find it, is a mere affirmation of the fact that it is not the parts, or it is not the, not the sum either. But what about its being other than that? That part is not resolved. So, and that still leaves open the possibility of it existing other than the cups, other than the parts or the sum of it, and at the same time existing so inherently. So in making this point, what I mean to suggest bringing in additional while we pursue this kind of analysis is to pursue the inherent existence of the cup, be that either being inherently one with the parts or the sum of it, or being inherently different than them, inherently separate from them. And when we have refuted these two, then we would have refuted its being inherently existent. Because for anything to exist inherently in relation to the parts of itself, it could either be inherently one with them or inherently other than, inherently separate than them. When we have dealt with both of these options and refuted them, then we would have ruled out its inherent existence by reason of having refuted its being inherently one with the parts of the sum, or inherently separate from the parts of the sum. But anyway, what I'm trying to convey here is that just as in science, they speak of water as an emergent property, even on a conventional level, this is not bringing in the ultimate mode of analysis into play. But rather, even speaking from a conventional sense, even scientists are, at least in that neuroscience text and biology text that I translate, the author, which are Western faculty members, are very comfortable in saying that the water is an emergent property of its building block in the form of hydrogen and oxygen. And that is the case on a conventional level, not by pursuing its ultimate analysis. Even given that of kind of water ends up being, not by being findable either of its components, either of its building blocks, be that hydrogen or that oxygen. It's by when the right amount of the atoms of them come together that we begin to have the first, the initial molecule of water. And in the scriptures, when making this case of how things do exist and are operational, functional, perfectly, while at the same time not having to have even the slightest iota of inherent existence, it resorts to these examples, even drawing from the Buddhist scriptures itself. Interestingly, one of those examples it draws is again that of water. Except in the Buddhist text, we do not speak of water being built from the components of hydrogen and oxygen. We speak of other non-water components that comes together in a particular proportion that makes water. So drawing from that explanation, it uses water as an example in conveying that there's nothing intrinsic in its building blocks, in its components. It at the same time, when they come together, we have water. Mm-hmm. And having water by that way is perfectly okay in having the functions of the water that is distinct from other things. Yeah. So from a Buddhist perspective, at least I'm not claiming that how what I understood is the exact emptiness as in the scriptures, but something that kind of something that points to this aspect of the reality of being posit or of being able to posit the functionality, operationality of things as they are, while at the same time without having to rely on any kind of intrinsic existence in and of themselves from the objective side. Yet at the same time, this understanding is not that easy to decide on. Rather, the process itself is rife with possibilities of mistaking it, and thus in the scriptures it lays up what do you call it? It lays out, it points out so many possible ways of mistaking it, so many possible ways of misconstruing it, mistaking it, and thus it makes this makes the case of taking one's time out in pursuing it currently never easily giving in to settling easily. So supposing we have gained some comfortable understanding of it, and a clear indication of having arrived at some correct understanding would be reflected in a sense of freedom that we experience, even though the understanding may not have been deepened so much in becoming completely integrated with our being, but the mere dawning of such an insight could be very relieving in that it kind of really strikes at the core of the afflictions, in really kind of exposing them to what they find as the to what they find or to what they depend on as their latching ground. So that is exposed and that is released. And in our own experience also, that could be felt as a relief from the grip of their afflictions, of having kind of denied them of their very indispensable lifeline in latching onto an objective. Objectivity, be that objective negativity of things, or be that objective positivity of things, either way, it kind of tightens the grip on an objective reality that then serves as the breeding ground for either clinging, or that of aversion, or that of indifference, all of those. So the scriptures suggest kind of balancing between pursuit of it intellectually, philosophically, yet at the same time kind of applying it to one's own experience in how that kind of induces some sense of relief, while at the same time such an insight still kind of retained the functionality, the conventionality of things, without compromising it, without messing with that, without compromising it. So one caution is that such a search doesn't make us slip into some kind of a cheap relativism, where we tend to be very naive about how to go about one's life. But rather, this pursuit of proper understanding should make us even more obedient, even more respectful, respecting of the fact of interdependence, in that we become more caring to work for the right causes and conditions for things to happen, by mere fact that that's all there is, with no intrinsic objective reality of its own from the object side. So those are the measures to kind of to look for, to check whether one is on the right track of pursuing it. And when we have understood it in this way, then the follow-up measure, the follow-up effort should be in integrating it, kind of not merely leaving it at the intellectual level, but integrating it. Integrating it, we will do well by applying that insight into who we are, into the nature of ourselves. As much as we may have begun this exploration by looking at the outside world and probing their nature, whatever insight we gain to this effect of seeing the reality more clearly in terms of being able to appreciate the connectivity, conventionality of things, while not having to subscribe to any kind of a objectivity, the main purpose of that is to then eventually apply to who oneself is, to one's own nature. Be able to see oneself in the light of that flexibility, while at the same time of that reality of being conventionally valid, yet at the same time lacking any kind of intrinsic objective reality. So that's the main crucial thing. That's why you hear in Buddhism you hear very much about the selflessness of person, selflessness of phenomena. And of the two, the selflessness of person is more crucial, because in the end, the actual transformation within oneself, in terms of making a difference with the afflictions, making a difference in terms of one's relationship with the afflictions, would happen only when we begin to see ourselves in the light of this new insight, and be able to kind of then be able to then integrate that. So that's the reason why selflessness of person is the ultimate goal to arrive at, pursuing, as we may have, first by looking into the external world, and then eventually whatever insight we got in this light to apply to our inner self, to then see ourselves in that light, and then by ramification, see the extensions in the same light. So that's why selflessness of person is very much emphasized. And then the last thing is, in the scripture, supposing that one has understood this to this extent, to actually pull up the strength, the required strength, to really deal that blow to the affliction, to the core, the root, and even further to the subtle stains of that, then it needs to be combined with as powerful a subjective agent. So it means kind of bringing about a refinement of the mind itself, of the subjective mind itself. In other words, the insight that we've just gained, let that be combined with even more refined level of consciousness, not merely settling on the usual conceptual thoughts, but if possible, engage in practices by which we could refine that subjective aspect of our being to kind of bringing it to more and more natural state. And then let that be the subjective component, subjective agent to handle this insight. And let that kind of be retained and pursued. And then the combination is supposed to be much, much stronger, much, much powerful in dealing a much thorough death blow to that affliction. So that's the idea behind that. But for that, first and foremost, one has to pursue this insight into the what we call the ultimate nature of things, what we call the ultimate mode of existence of things, to the extent of kind of bringing, to the extent of exposing our ingrained self-grasping to the fullness, and then, yeah, to the fullness. And so that's the idea behind that. And in the modern time, the quantum mechanics in what it relates in terms of its findings, in terms of the very unpredictable nature of light, whatnot, seems to lend some credibility to this Madhyamika take of how things naturally abide, how the operationality of things is fully possible only on this ground of having not the slightest iota of intrinsic aspect whatsoever. So I think with that, we'll stop here. If there are any more time, then we can have questions. I think there's hardly any time. So what do you suggest to me?
Maybe one or two questions.
Okay, please do.
Thank you. If anybody has. So, how would you suggest examining mind so that you could identify it so you could do this analysis? It's very difficult to identify that very basic consciousness. How would you suggest going about that?
Yes, in this regard, your question prompted me to again share something. As much as I say that one way of approaching this insight is first kind of looking into the external world almost as an intellectual pursuit, then eventually kind of bringing that back to reflect on one's being and there more particularly into one's mind. That's one way of approach. Another way of approach is kind of just begin by watching oneself, begin by looking inward, and then from there, gaining some grasp at the way the mind and the person exists, and then from there you can then move out into seeing everything in the same form or same nature. Now, there are these two traditions there. We call that tato ni gomdzeba, pursuing meditation pursuing meditation from an intellectual pursuit of the view, and then the other one is pursuing the view from the viewpoint of meditation. So anyway, in terms of the mind, the analysis, the nature of the analysis kind of more or less takes the same form, except one has to remember to bring in that added, added nuance, added component of not merely searching for it within its temporal past. In the case of the mind, we wouldn't be so much speaking of spatial past, but rather its temporal past. Let's look at look within and see which is this mind. Is it the one that the moment ago, the moment later, and what about the present moment? Is within the present moment, one would still begin to see temporal past, and one would be at sea, at loss as to what is the present moment. Likewise, so in the case of the mind, we'll be particularly playing with its temporal parts, of course, with its objects that it apprehends, but more so in the light of its temporal parts, and then kind of teasing them apart, one doesn't find mind, while at the same time its reality is very, very clearly felt. It affects us, and nonetheless, when we pursue it beyond the very thin line of conventionality, we'll be at sea in finding or landing on anything. And yet at the same time, so in terms of unfindability, while pursuing through it, while looking into the past, be that temporal past or not, it's the same thing, except one has to be mindful in bringing this awareness that what we are looking for is an intrinsic, we're not looking for the mind, but we are looking for an intrinsic mind. If mind were to exist intrinsically, then it would have to either exist intrinsically one with its temporal past, or intrinsically separate from its temporal past. And then through this observation, kind of see if we could land on ruling out both of them, ruling out either of them. And that way, kind of fall back onto the reality of the mind, yet at the same time, not in an intrinsic sense in any way. So looking in and looking into the temporal parts, of course, we come across scriptures when it says, oh, the mind has no color, no shape, whatnot. That is one way of looking at it, but that is not the whole story, because mind in the first place has no color, it has no shape, it is by very nature non-physical. So there is no such, so there's no question of its being findable in terms of its color, shape, or not. But that's one way of looking at it, saying, does it have a color, does it have a shape? Okay, but other than that, what does it have? And what does its reality feel like? That's when it leads us into looking into the temporal parts of it. If we tease out the temporal parts, we don't land onto anything. But then the important thing is to remind ourselves that that's not, because mind, the way it is, and so is the case with everything, the way things are, they're given to be not findable. They're given to be not findable. If we search them in this way, not being merely content with the national, the conventional reality of them, but if we push beyond that and search for them, they are not, it's but natural for them not to be found. That's not, that is an indication of something bigger than that, something deeper than that. But at the same time, that is not the whole story. So kind of bringing in this added awareness that what you're looking for is an intrinsic mind. Any such thing were to exist, then it would have to be findable within the parts or outside of it. But then it is untenable either way for it to be intrinsically one with its temporal part or separate from its temporal part. That's how one then settles on to its reality, yet at the same time not intrinsically so. That's what I think is the way.
Any more questions?
So I have a question. We were talking about in the break your use of the word ultimate for ultimate reality. What are some different ways you would translate that, and why don't you like the word ultimate?
Earlier, when I was saying, just using the term ultimate for the Dandam Temba, the Paratma Satya, is not right, because particularly at the lower tenet school, there's nothing ultimate about when they speak of something as being the Paramatma Satya. They're not speaking of it in terms of any ultimate thing, whereas that is the case from the Citta Matra and the Madhyamika point of view. When they speak of two truths of them, the Paramatma Satya has some bearing on something being ultimate in the nature, but not in the context of the Vaibhasika and the Svatantrika. So one would have to search for some other option. The one that people usually land onto is absolute truth, but that is too radical, too strong a word. So I don't know. But ultimate is not the way to go about, at least in the context of Vaibhasika and Svatantrika.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Yeah. Thank you. Can we say dedication prayers for you before we finish? We do a short.
Pardon? Oh yeah. And yes, please. Prayers.
Sahi Puki to Shane
Thank you so very much.